Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capitol Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you this morning?
Feeling great.
I'm feeling great, too. I'll tell you, today, one of the things that I want to talk about is vinegar.
Vinegar?
Mm-hmm.
You get more flies with honey, you know.
But I don't want flies. You're just the king of the cliche this morning.
I had a little bit for you there.
Super duper.
I was ready for you, wasn't I?
That was good. You know, I was reading Food & Wine magazine, which is a great magazine that we both enjoy. And there was an article by Paula Wolfert on vinegar, and it really struck a note. I know a number of people who make their own vinegars.
Well, I don't know if you know this, but way back when my great-grandmother, as a young girl with her mother, came over to the United States.
From Italy.
One of the things that they carried with them was what's called the mother vinegar, and they brought their big vinegar pots with them, and my aunt still has them. They're still in tip-top condition, and they're the vinegar pots because that was such an important part of their culture, was your own vinegar and your own house style of vinegar.
My great-grandmother came over with a potato, and we keep the potato on the mantelpiece still.
Excellent.
It's sprouted now.
We actually had vinegar, but seriously, your house style of vinegar, I mean, it was as integral to your cooking and your style of cooking as was any other ingredient that you would use. And, I mean, they cared enough to bring this on the boat with them when they came over. Francis, when I tell you it is a giant pot, it's got to be, the equivalent of 30 quarts, 40-quart pot to carry the vinegar and the mother and
40 quarts.
The vinegar.
10 gallons,
it's
maybe.
Big, about 10 gallons. Well, I was thinking,
no,
30
actually,
quarts, 40 quarts.
Actually, Mark, 40 quarts is exactly 10 gallons.
Hold on, I got to do some math. Yeah, okay, 40 quarts is 10 gallons. How many gallons is 30 quarts, smart guy?
less than 10. That'd be 9, 8, 7.5 gallons. Okay.
It's nice to see that your math skills are the same as ever.
Vinegar is amazing. Now, we have a situation.
Whether it's 30 quarts or 40 quarts,
exactly.
It's still amazing.
Well, you bring up a good point, though. We have available to us in the United States some great balsamic vinegars. These are the fine, artisanal, expensive vinegars that are not the stuff you. A lot of the stuff you find on the supermarket shelf isn't very good, but really great vinegar is available.
And those, balsamic vinegars are aged over a long, long
some,
period of time.
No,
the good ones.
Not
the good
stuff
ones. Right, not the stuff on the supermarket
A lot shelf. Of the stuff on the supermarket shelf that's marked balsamic vinegar is a real ripoff. But if it says balsamic vinegar of Modena, and it also is from Italy, you're more likely to get a better vinegar.
You need to check both of those things. Look for the word Modena, and then also look for the word Italy.
And that you know, you have a good shot of getting a decent vinegar, but there are all ranges of quality. Quality, but what most people would use in vinegar, not just for the acid, and we're taught, and if you take basic cooking, you'll understand that people use vinegar to provide an acidic component to a dish that needs acid, but that's not all it's for. Great red wine vinegar in particular, and wine vinegar in particular, has complexities similar to wine. I mean, you don't drink it because we don't want to drink that much acidic acid, which is the acid in vinegar. But it can add a tremendous amount of complexity and richness to dishes, not just dressings, to marinades, to all sorts of things, to deglazing a pan. And you can make vinegar at home. And that's what this article by Paula Wolfert was all about. It talked about making vinegar at home. And it's not that difficult. I think you may be able to find this article if you go to foodandwine.com, maybe foodandwine.com/Wolfert.
We'll try and link you to it if it's still available to us.
But what you need to make vinegar at home is you need a warm place where you can put vinegar, the making vinegar, because it takes weeks to make vinegar. It takes months, actually, to make vinegar. It takes about 2.5 months to make something decent, and can be even longer. And the way that it works is you take red wine. People use cider and stuff, but red wine or wine makes the best vinegar. And you have a mother.
Sherry actually also makes some.
Right. Well, that's a type of wine. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But the you take what's called a mother, and the mother is what converts the wine into vinegar. And that's you keep coming back to the mother, and it goes through the mother, and you can the mother
it,
will.
What it does, it takes it and it makes it a more controlled. Changing to acid, and in that way you can while the vinegar will indeed be different every single time you make it, you'll develop kind of a house style of vinegar.
And mother, like a particular mother, imparts this particular kind of flavor. So it has to do with what kind of wine you put in it and what kind of mother you have, and then depending on what kind of wine you put in it will change the mother.
Will change the mother over time.
These
exactly.
mothers can last 40, 50, 60, 80, 90 years.
Theoretically forever.
Like a starter, you know? And so when your great-grandmother came over from Italy, the mother was fairly dry, but she that mother was then used again when they
Absolutely.
Got over here.
I'm certain that
would
you
be
know.
Seized by customs today. You would not be able to bring the mother over.
Yeah, you probably can't do that, can you?
But what happens is also the thing about making a vinegar in your house, it uses the ambient, the spores, the microorganisms that are in the air, the microflora in the air. So if I make vinegar in my house and Mark makes the vinegar with the same mother and the same wine in his house, it's going to taste slightly different.
Yeah, mostly because my house is cleaner than yours.
Yeah, could be, but mine may be better for vinegar than yours. And so the idea of, you know, it's funny because I have if you're a wine lover, making your own vinegar is tremendous. Now, it takes about 2.5 months, and you leave it in a cheesecloth-covered open-top container someplace between 70 and 80 degrees for 2.5 months because you can't close the top. It's an aerobic reaction. Mm-hmm. It's not an anaerobic reaction. But if you're a wine lover, this is very often a way to take wine on the second day or the third day or the day after. You don't want, like, it wasn't good enough. You had a half a bottle left. You had a quarter bottle left. You had a little bit left in the glass. You put this into your vinegar, and as long as you, my friend Peter Schleimer is an Austrian restaurant critic, wine writer, food writer, and he has an amazing 20-year-old vinegar collection, various mothers kept in various places, because he gets these wine samples sent to his house all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has a million half-full bottles of wine.
And something I'll tell you about making vinegar is that, you know, if you use some really interesting, really good wines in it, you have a higher chance of getting really interesting, really good vinegar.
And what Peter always says, though, is you have to take care of your mother because, you know, and it's a joke, right? You have to take care of your mother, but you need to take care of the mother and keep it alive. And he has several mothers going, they have to keep in several places because they'll cross-contaminate each other if they're in the same room. But he makes vinegars, and when he comes from Austria, what I love when he brings me as a present.
Can you do me a favor not use the word contaminate anymore when you're talking about my
cross,
food?
whatever. But he brings me different vinegars, and his vinegars are because he gets these great wines delivered to his home that he needs to professionally rate and review, but he's like, I can't, you know, drink them.
Going to drink 30 bottles of wine in one night.
He has iced wine vinegar. I mean, he has vinegars made from $75 bottles of wine, or the remnants of $75 bottles of wine. These things are incredible.
Mm.
And, you know, I use them all the time. And, frankly, these incredible vinegars, sometimes I'll just put some on top of a roast beef sandwich.
Yeah.
Amazing, right? Yeah. And sometimes I'll use them in my cooking. And just amazing.
My guess is about 2.5 months you might want to come to one of our restaurants and
see
what kind of vinegar we're using.
Mark's going to call up his aunt and try and get that vinegar, the vinegar pot
yep,
over. And
absolutely.
I'm going to call Peter and see if I can bring some mother in my pocket.
That would
from
be
Austria.
Against the law. Yeah. You would never do that.
Well, if I got my fingers dirty and just didn't wash them until I got back here, would that still be against the law?
I don't think that works.
All right, we're going to talk about sweeter...
Never mind.
We're going to talk about sweeter things than vinegar in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Cafe Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Rowan Jacobson. Rowan is the former managing editor of the Healing Arts Press and a longtime health writer. He's the author of Chocolate Unwrapped, The Surprising Health Benefits of America's Favorite Passion. And he joins us today to discuss, well, food in general, but specifically a great article that Mark and I found in The Art of Eating on umami.
Rowan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rowan, first of all, we love The Art of Eating, That's really a cool publication that you're involved with. We had Ed Baer on the show recently talking about
just
it.
Last week.
And you can go to our website out there in Listener Land if you want to subscribe. It's a food quarterly. They do in-depth articles on various things about food. It's great. TheArtOfEating.com. Now, why don't you tell our audience actually what umami is?
Well, umami is a fifth taste that we all have. We all grew up learning that we had four different types of taste buds that could detect.
I'm pretty sure that's what Mrs. Story said in second grade.
There you go.
Four tastes.
And that segment on taste in second grade when we learned about salty, sweet, bitter, and sour. But it turns out that we have a fifth taste bud that detects what's called umami. And the reason it has a name like umami is because it was first identified in Japan by a researcher there about 100 years ago. And what it basically is a...
So hold on, Rowan. If it was identified 100 years ago, why were my textbooks in the 70s? Was it not included?
Well, we in the West were a little slow to catch on.
Again?
It's basically a what's been described as a brothy or a savory taste.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you picture the flavor of chicken stock or mm-hmm. beef stock mm-hmm. and take away the saltiness of it, what's left is pretty much the essence of umami. But this food researcher in Japan, in I think it was 1907, he was drinking a bowl of dashi, which is the stock that they usually use in Japan,
mm-hmm.
which has two ingredients, kelp and dried tuna flakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a flavor that he felt was not salt, sour, sweet, or bitter. It was something distinctly different, and he decided that the kelp was what was really responsible for that. So he analyzed the kelp and discovered an amino acid in the kelp called glutamate, which was what was providing that fifth taste. He called it umami, which is in Japan pretty much means delicious. It's the essence of deliciousness. And he actually then founded a company that began manufacturing a powdered version of glutamate called monosodium glutamate, or as we call it, MSG.
Uh-oh, that's MSG's got a bad rap.
Yeah, MSG is pure umami.
And so
connotations of MSG is that it's bad for you, gives you headaches, every bad Chinese restaurant uses way too much of it.
What's the skinny?
All right, here's the skinny. A few people decided that they had headaches or dizziness after eating in Chinese restaurants way back in the 30s or the 40s. And they said, what's up with this? And somebody decided maybe it was the MSG that was already at that time traditionally added to a lot of Chinese food simply because Chinese chefs were familiar with MSG and it hadn't really come west yet.
And just as far as the Westerners who might, places you would find MSG, there's a product on the market called Accent that used to be on in every kitchen just about, I think. And Accent is MSG.
Right. It's about four-fifths MSG mm-hmm. and one-fifth salt.
How did we get... A couple of people decided they got dizzy, and they blamed it on the MSG just because that was the thing that was unfamiliar to them in the kitchen? Is that what that was?
Right, and, well, they thought maybe MSG was responsible. So this German researcher took a bunch of rats and injected them with huge syringes of monosodium glutamate, and sure enough, the rats got sick.
Well, I guess if you inject a little rat with a huge syringe of just about anything, it's not going to be too helpful.
Right. If he had injected them with that much sugar or salt, the rats probably would have just flat out died.
But, uh-huh.
So anyway, people decided that MSG was responsible for this, and despite a lot of evidence since then, it hasn't really been possible to turn the public around. But all the research that's been done seems to show that MSG is completely safe unless, you know, you inject yourself with a huge syringe of it.
And no one's advocating that.
Right.
Can it be overdone, though? Can a restaurant that has powdered MSG just use too much of it? And what happens if they do? Or is it totally benign?
It is benign in terms of health. In
but for flavor?
Flavor, no. It's, you know, as with salt, it's useful to think of umami as we would salt. A little of it makes everything else taste better. It heightens the flavor of all the other tastes and aromas that are in a dish. too much of it, and it starts to kill the flavor and take over and really flatten out the dish.
But at the same time, if you have too much salt, you don't feel good.
Right. Salt's actually a lot more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this, again, we're talking about umami, which is the fifth taste, and umami is something that we've identified in the West only recently, and chefs have an inherent knowledge of umami and how to use it in making dishes and putting things together. We're going to be talking more about that.
I have a very funny story about chefs who overuse their use of MSG.
We're going to talk more. We're going to talk about that in just a moment with Rowan Jacobson, who's written an article in The Art of Eating on umami. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Ring in 2007 at just such a gathering with us. The Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally. She's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn. And on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, an evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or Catherine Lombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurant. We're speaking with Rowan Jacobson about his article on umami, published recently in The Art of Eating. And umami is often comes from, not the only source, but can come from MSG.
So, Rowan, I have to say, we recently took over for an establishment that was formerly a Chinese restaurant. We built an Italian restaurant in its stead. And one of the things that we found, and now this restaurant had all over its paperwork, no MSG, no MSG, we don't use MSG. Well, we walked up into the kitchen of this particular establishment, and what we found were three 100-pound barrels of MSG. So I think they might not have been telling the truth.
It could have made the whole Raritan River taste better for 3 days.
That's true. It would have been pretty brothy.
Three 100-pound barrels, and what I thought was, isn't one 100-pound barrel enough?
That's a little heavy hand with the MSG. But you know, actually, Western chefs may not realize they're doing the same. They're using umami the same way, just in maybe slightly more natural, sophisticated forms, such as anchovies, Parmesan cheese.
Well, that's what I want to talk about.
Right.
Umami doesn't just come from the powdered form of umami. When we want to infuse our dishes with the flavor of umami, where else does it come from? What things do we put in our food, and whether we know it or not, we're trying to impart that umami flavor?
The classic places that you get a lot of umami is in the condiments. Parmesan cheese, Romano cheese that you grate on dishes, anchovies, soy sauce.
Mm-hmm. It seems that every culture, though, has their own umami that is ubiquitous.
Right, and the ubiquitous source of umami in the United States is ketchup.
Ah, sauce americaine. Yes. Well, is that from the tomatoes?
Yeah,
is that where the umami comes from?
Yeah, vegetables don't tend to have as much umami as some other products, but tomatoes are the highest of any vegetables. So you take, in fact, ketchup is kind of an ideal combination of all the flavors. You've got the umami and sweetness from the tomato. Mm-hmm. You've got salt. You've got some sour in there.
Yeah. And, I have to say, I spent a little time in the south of Portugal, and I went to go to this Canadian bar, and I would go get something to eat in there once in a while. My friend Kurt and I were there many, many years ago, and the bartender would say, they'd see us come in, and they had these stupid little bottles of ketchup, and we'd use, like, two bottles every time we had dinner there, and like, more sauce American, they're back. We'll be back after the news, talking with Rowan Jacobson about umami, the fifth flavor, and there are all sorts of ways that we need to know about how we use umami or glutamate that's not necessarily monosodium glutamate
and
in our own cuisine.
How we can use it to enhance our food.
And how important it is, and you're using it whether you know it or not, so you better know how to use it right. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today, our guest is Rowan Jacobson. He's the former managing editor of the Healing Arts Press and a longtime health writer. He's the author of Chocolate Unwrapped, The Surprising Health Benefits of America's Favorite Passion. And he joins us today to discuss an article he wrote on umami, the fifth taste, that he recently published in The Art of Eating. We were talking before in the news about how umami is imparted sometimes. The simplest way to do it is to use monosodium glutamate. But umami, that meaty flavor, that fifth flavor, comes to your food through a number of different sources. We talked about tomatoes being unusual in that it's a vegetable with a lot of umami flavor. Are there meats, are all meats, they have umami, or they have differing parts of umami?
All meats have some umami. Umami is really a taste for protein, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's rather than protein in its healthy live form, it's a taste for protein that has been broken down in one way or another,
mm-hmm.
either through long cooking or through fermentation, or through drying it and aging it. Anything that really beats up that protein starts to break it down into the amino acids that it's made of.
So umami is not present in a raw piece of chicken.
Right. Raw chicken, raw beef isn't going to have umami, but once you age it, or if you cook it for a long time, stew it, or even as the animal gets older, it starts to develop a little as its own body starts to break down. But then you start to get that savoriness that we all like.
So basically, you're talking about on a molecular level, when the protein breaks down, you get, you know, incomplete molecules that are that light up your taste.
So, for instance, when you're aging beef for 14 days, you're creating umami.
Right. Some of the protein that is the muscle of the beef starts to break apart into its constituent amino acids, and that tastes really good to us for some reason.
It is that sort of taste of protein. You mentioned a couple of other things that different cultures have different ubiquitous sources of umami, you know, that may not be seaweed, but you talk about prosciutto and you talk about Parmigiano Reggiano and anchovies. One of the things that you mentioned in your article, which I thought is a great part of food history. It's kind of a gross part of food history. Ancient Romans, you reference the garum that was the sauce that ancient Romans used as we use ketchup in America today. Can you tell us about garum?
Garum, the Romans and the Greeks before them had a sauce which is similar to the fish sauce that's used in Asian cultures today. Basically, they would take a lot of little fish, anchovies, sardines, that type of fish, and heat them in the sun and let them just ferment in the sun for quite a while.
Yeah, ferment and rot are very close when you're talking about fish, aren't they?
Yeah, you know.
And they would just make a sauce out of the bloody remains?
Eventually, yeah, all the guts would just break down into this black liquid, and they drain the black liquid off, and they put it on absolutely everything. Those ancient Roman cookbooks call for it in pretty much every dish.
Have you ever had anything like it?
Well, I've had a fish sauce. In fact, since I started researching umami, I've been using a lot more fish sauce, which is made the same way. I think it's got a little bit less guts in it and a little bit more just fish.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's fish sauce is ubiquitous in Vietnam, Thailand, and the rest of Southeast Asia. You can get a bottle for $3 at any decent supermarket, and use it pretty much like you would use soy sauce.
Yeah, in this area, we have a lot of Asian supermarkets too, and you can.
Yeah.
It's very easy to find.
Yeah,
I find that anytime if you're making any kind of a sauce or a stew or anything, and it tastes, you feel like it needs something, like and you've already put salt in it, so you know it's not salt. A little shot of fish sauce, even in something that you wouldn't want to taste fishy, it just perks the flavor right up.
You know, I remember reading, I like reading about food history, and I've read a couple of accounts of how the garum was made, or the old Roman fish sauce was made, and it just, I hope and pray that the Asian fish sauces are made a little more sanitarily and not with as many guts laying out on the dock to ferment into black sludge.
I make you no promise.
Well, just allow me to continue in my misconception if that's the case. Now, Worcestershire sauce also is an umami imparter, isn't it?
Yes, it actually has anchovies in it. Some people don't realize that. Vegetarians, there's certain vegetarians are well aware of that fact because they have to steer clear of Worcestershire.
And certain vegetarians aren't,
are really mad at you for telling them.
Or their boyfriends who are carnivores or have one more thing off the list of things that they can have. You talk in your article about how umami interacts with beverages, with wine, for example. And how does it react with wine? Do we have certain things we need to look for?
Well, there's a lot of controversy in that area. A lot of people are talking about that, and there doesn't seem to be agreement yet. But a couple things seem to be coming clear. Wine has a lot of a different kind of umami called synergizing umami, and anything that's made with yeast develops this other kind of umami. But wine also, red wine anyway, has bitterness in it.
Mm-hmm.
And foods that are high in umami, such as caviar is a good example, don't always play well with wine. Something about the umami and the bitterness in the wine clash, and what you're left with is a metallic taste.
But there are some high umami foods that are great. I mean, when you start talking about bacon or ham or things like that, they can go miraculously with the right wine.
Exactly. And often wines that don't have that bitterness to them.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny when you put food and wine together. Especially when you have a very strong umami flavor, a very strong salty flavor. It makes for its own challenges. And one of the things that I always suggest to people who are having dinner parties at home is if you're having a bunch of courses, especially if you're having like anchovies in a course, and you're going to open four or five bottles of wine for you and your friends over the course of the evening, I recommend opening all of the bottles of wine, and you and your friends can mess around and see what goes best with each course. I think people it's our job in restaurants, you know, you have a people come in and you're going to drink one bottle with each course, and it's our job to know what's in our cellar, and it's our job to know our food. And a good sommelier will sort of be able to take you through and help you pick bottles that work with each course. But at home, I mean, half the fun is figuring out what works and what doesn't. And with wine, when you open up all the bottles and put them all on the table for people to pick what they like, I think that's a ton of fun.
You know, there's another alternative here as well, and we talk about wine all the time, but certain of these umami foods are just going to go better with cocktails, or they're going to go better with beer, or they're going to go better with sake, as opposed to traditional Western European wine.
Is it your impression that beer and sake work better with high umami foods?
It is. I would definitely say so. Sake is actually higher in umami than wine. Rice has more protein in it. Grapes have no protein in them, basically. Mm-hmm. Rice does have some protein. And sake is also fermented for about twice as long as wine typically is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that extra long fermentation really cranks up the umami level. So sake plays, and sake doesn't have any bitterness in it, so it plays very well with high umami foods. Usually.
Well, I find that with high umami foods, sake works extremely well, and you're seeing in Western restaurants more and more of them have a sake list with at least a few selections of high quality sake. And when you look at it, sake and beer, sake is a beer, it's not a wine, because you know beer comes from grain, and they work differently. And frankly, it's harder to have a miss. I don't think that you get the magical heights that you get with, you know, when you have a fantastic wine expertly paired with a great piece of food. To me, that's still the ultimate in flavor combinations. But it's much harder to miss with beer and food and with sake and food, especially when you're talking about high umami foods. What's your take on that, Rowan?
I agree for sure. You don't a great red wine with just the right, you know, beef bourguignon or just the right dish. You've got all those aromas going on.
Yeah, but
so it's not just merely the umami. It takes off to a whole different level. But yes, the sake has it's really just the flavor of fermentation that you're left with.
Mm-hmm.
Sake, because after that rice is polished down to just the pure starch, it's not contributing much except what the yeast needs to create the alcohol. So what you're left with is a perfect match for oysters or a lot of these other foods that are high in umami and can be difficult.
Our guest is Rowan Jacobson. The article he wrote on umami is in The Art of Eating, which you can find out about our website. You can also find out more about him on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And we'll be back in just a moment to talk more with him about the fifth taste. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply Company is the oldest dealership in New Jersey. They've been equipping and supplying restaurants since 1932, and they know that to make great food, you need great equipment. You need equipment that doesn't break down, and you can't pay too much for it. Whether you need an emergency replacement or a wholesale kitchen renovation, Economy's knowledge, experience, and integrity are indispensable. Economy Paper and Restaurant Supply is a recognized dealer for all major brands, and they specialize in custom fabrication and ventilation. At Economy, they've got all the tools you need to get the job done, all in one place, all priced right, and delivered to your door. Economy is the only dealer in New Jersey that's been approved for on-site demonstrations of the Rational Combi Oven. The Rational Combi Oven is an innovative combination of convection and adjustable steam oven. It's a powerful and versatile tool in your kitchen's arsenal. They also supply competitively priced paper products and all the non-food supplies every restaurant needs. You can visit the Economy Demo Kitchen on Broad Street in Clifton, New Jersey. You can also visit economysupply.com, then call them at 973-279-5500. That's 973-279-5500. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants. Our guest today is Rowan Jacobson. He's the author of many articles and several books. We were talking with him in the last couple of segments about umami, or the meaty flavor that sometimes is associated with MSG, but is much more important than that and much more broadly understood. And you should check out him through our website, and theartofeating.com through our website. He's also the author of the book Chocolate Unwrapped, The Surprising Health Benefits of America's Favorite Passion.
You got to tell us a little bit about the surprising health benefits of chocolate.
Because I should be really healthy, by the way, if it's good for you.
Right. Well, the surprise is that we should all be eating more chocolate.
Oh, yeah. You're my favorite author now. Tell us why.
We know chocolate makes us feel better, okay? You can ask any woman on the face of the planet, and they will tell you that chocolate actually makes them feel better.
Woman?
And what I was about to say is, and you can ask Francis and me, and we will tell you the same thing.
So what's the scoop, man? Give me every rationalization I can to eat as much chocolate as possible.
All right. You like, chocolate is the food that is perhaps the highest in flavonoids, which...
Antioxidants.
Exactly. Antioxidants that improve our cardiovascular function quite a bit. And there's a good bit of research now that shows that consumption of maybe a third of a bar of chocolate a day can lengthen your life and significantly reduce your risk of heart attack or stroke.
Well, it reduces my stress, so that's one of the ways it could do
well,
that.
Well, and I guess
without the flavonoids.
I guess my question is to you, what about three chocolate bars a day?
Well, you know, there is that catch there, actually, which is that it has to be dark chocolate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I love dark chocolate.
One of the problems that we have when we eat our chocolate is you know, the other things that we put into it, it's not actually the chocolate. Is that correct?
Right. If you're getting a typical bar of Hershey's milk chocolate, it's got a little chocolate in there and a lot of sugar and some milk.
Now, but is there a downside? Because I like really dark chocolate from really good producers, and there's one actually here locally. We'll throw in a little plug for our friends who own Burn Chocolate. The factory is in Highland Park. You can look it up. And though they have a little store where you can go in and buy the stuff fresh made, it's amazing, and their dark chocolate is amazing. Now, is too much bad for you?
If you really went to town, I suppose you'd be consuming a fair number of calories.
Yeah, you're talking to those guys, in case you're wondering.
Town's where we go. We're big town guys.
We're going to loot, we're going to pillage, we're going to do all sorts of bad things while we're there.
Well, all right, if you can loot and pillage the chocolate, as long as you then choose not to loot and pillage, you know, something else.
But the chocolate itself doesn't do you any more harm to have a little more than you.
No, chocolate is good food. If you're getting, you know, 60 or 70% cocoa content in your chocolate.
Yeah, that's what we do.
You're getting an incredible hit of antioxidants.
That's why I do it. I just have to suffer through it for the antioxidants.
It's all about the antioxidants.
Right, let's go back to the book on chocolate. So you wrote this book talking about how chocolate is really good for people. How has it been received by both, you know, the dietary nutritional community and by people? I mean, I would think you'd be lauded as a hero from 9-year-olds across America.
Well, you know what happens is that here in my hometown, women come up to me who I've never seen before. They walk up to me and say, "I think of you every time I eat a piece of chocolate."
Oh, Lord.
Well, that's changed my life.
That doesn't seem like such a bad thing.
No, that's pretty good. Yeah, people love that book because it gives them license to do exactly what they want to do anyway.
So what's the premise of the book? What other than the obvious, what have I not stated about the book, about why chocolate is good for you and how chocolate is good for you?
Well, we just have it ingrained deeply in us that chocolate is bad. There's something about chocolate that is just bad.
Well, there is something in our culture that makes us say if something tastes good, it's probably bad for us.
Right. It's a pleasure thing. You know, when we were kids, we were told to somehow conditioned to believe that we were being naughty if we ate chocolate.
Right, you can only have so much.
Because it was just too good.
Uh-huh. So now, where's
the whole Catholic thing, though, too, in my background. You know, the better it feels, the worse it is.
Yeah.
The bigger the sin.
Yeah.
Right. And it feels pretty good.
And it does, and it does feel pretty good. Now, where has the research come about that says that chocolate is good for us? And you know, how do you cover that in your book?
One of researchers' initial clues is that there's an indigenous culture that lives off the coast of Panama, and just the Maya Indians were the first culture to really perfect cocoa.
Making cocoa, right.
And then this group off the coast of Panama, still a big portion of their diet is cocoa. They drink 5 or 6 cups a day of this intense chocolate mixture.
Mm-hmm.
So they're getting,
and it can be spicy, and you know, it's not sweet like what we're drinking.
What they're drinking is not sweet, exactly. Mm-hmm. Which is the key. Like the worst thing you're doing when you're eating chocolate is you're getting some sugar, although not as much as people think. But so this group off of Panama had incredible rates of incredibly healthy cardiovascular systems.
Oh, and they lived a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the heart attacks were almost unknown to them. So researchers were trying to figure out what it was, and they finally decided maybe it was the chocolate. And since then, they've been testing it on volunteers and
on volunteers.
How do
nice.
I sign up for
yeah.
that? Where
you know, it could
I...
also have been that they didn't eat their chocolate sitting behind their desk, though.
Yeah.
You know, Ron, has anyone considered that?
But where do I sign up for the chocolate study? So the test on Western is that when you modify someone's diet to increase the cocoa intake, you get the same kind of benefits.
Yeah, increased life expectancy, lower cholesterol, 50% reduced risk of stroke or heart attack.
And chocolate. These are a few of my favorite things.
Okay, everybody, here's permission to eat chocolate and the bittersweet stuff and not too much sugar. Rowan Jacobson is the author of Chocolate Unwrapped, The Surprising Health Benefits of America's Favorite Passion. And you can find out more about that at our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Hey, Rowan, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks very much, Ron.
You're listening to The Restaurant Guy. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis from Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi's restaurant. Our guest was Rowan Jacobson. We talked about chocolate, which everybody loves. You should check out his book on our website. We also talked about umami, the fifth taste, that meaty, sexy taste.
So you know that one of the most umami flavors. Do you know what food it comes in?
Yeah, I read the book. I read the article. One of the great sources of umami, Jacobson tells us in his article, in The Art of Eating, is breast milk. And he writes rather whimsically, add a little breast milk to your bechamel for a je ne sais quoi that will have your guests clamoring for more.
There's a whole new market for human cheese out there coming soon.
C'est quoi? I'm looking for volunteers, Mark, and I want to try this.
I do not wish to try it. Thank you very much.
And invite Rowan Jacobson over for dinner.
That is clearly the grossest thing that I've ever heard.
It's sort of gross and sort of twisted sexy.
Oh, you are twisted.
Well,
shame on you.
But it does talk about early food associations, and that's why
I'm not sitting next to you in the studio anymore.
What we like when we're young. When you're introduced to stuff as a child, and that's normal, mm-hmm. that becomes comfort food for you. And so parents who, you know, you have kids, don't, if you have a kid where you can introduce them to a wide variety of foods at a young age, do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we get a lot of teenagers who eat butter and pasta and they don't want anything else because they weren't introduced to foods when they were younger. And they've also shown that pregnant women who eat a wide variety of foods when they're pregnant their children wind up with a broader spectrum of taste.
Right. They like a lot of different flavors and a lot of different tastes, especially things like vegetables and things like that that traditionally kids won't eat. It is a way that and it's not a fail-proof way. I mean, I'll tell you, I have four kids, and some of my kids eat a spectacular array of foods, and some of my kids a less spectacular array.
And so we found out that it's not just MSG. It exists in the real food. We have to be careful of umami. You can find more about it from Growing Proof website. And we've also found out that the best source of umami is your mommy. Hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys.
I stopped enjoying it about 2 minutes ago.
I am Francis Shaw.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.